Hey everyone, and welcome back to your weekly Linux and open source news show. I'm your host, Nick, and this is a podcast where I discuss everything that is related to Linux, open source, privacy, the open web, and everything around that. And this week we have a good one. We've got an NVIDIA roadmap for Linux development, specifically for Wayland development, because X11 is dead and it's not coming back. We also have issues with Tuxedo drivers. A Linux kernel developer is trying to isolate them because they're not truly compatible as is with the Linux kernel unless you ship them as an external module, and some people are taking offense at that. We also have news about Ubuntu 25.04 and what it will include. We've got a big update to DXVK. We've got some more AI-related stuff that shows it's really not as good as people are telling it is. We've got some more European actors banding together to build a new online search index that is independent from Google and from Microsoft, and a lot of other things. So as always, if you want to dive deeper into any of these topics, you know what to do. All the links are in the show notes. And if you want to support this show and keep it going, you also know what to do. All the links to do that are in the show notes, and you'll get some pretty cool perks in the process. So NVIDIA outlined their plans for Wayland support and the current issues with Wayland specifically, or at least the limitations of NVIDIA drivers for Wayland. Currently, Wayland protocols do not support certain things that exist in the NVIDIA drivers in their X.org version. And so NVIDIA can't and won't implement them for Wayland. This includes SLI-related things, so dual GPU setups where both your GPUs are plugged in into one another. Virtually no one uses that in a real day-to-day scenario. Some workstations might, but in the consumer market, SLI has been abandoned a while back. There's also the NVIDIA settings panel. Plenty of settings in there just cannot be handled by the driver directly on Wayland, notably everything related to display configuration, so the NVIDIA settings app will never have feature parity between Wayland and X11. Again, not necessarily a big deal because all of these options are available in your desktop environment settings anyway. Now, what they do have planned for Wayland, though, is multi-monitor variable refresh rate support, which is really nice. They'll also set a specific frame buffer parameter to fix some output issues and bugs that they have right now. But more importantly, they want to work on something they already talked about a while back, which is a display multiplexer to connect the discrete GPU to the built-in display or an external display without having to rely on the integrated GPU to pass that information through. Apparently, no Wayland compositor currently supports this. Hopefully, this becomes a priority because hybrid laptops are everywhere these days and they kind of need this feature. They also want to add support for the color management pipeline that everyone has been working on, specifically KDE. It's the HDR support stuff, plus support for VDP-AU, an open source video decoding library, and support for virtual GPU, which is the ability to use a real physical GPU inside of multiple VMs, notably useful for servers that handle many VMs and want to bring them graphical acceleration with just one card. I think it's a solid list of improvements, and I don't think many people will lament what cannot be added to Wayland right now. Like the NVIDIA settings, who really uses that? The app was terrible and everything you could set in there can already be set anywhere else in your desktop environment settings. SLI, I haven't seen a single person use that in 5 to 10 years. I don't think it's a thing in the consumer market, at least. Maybe in some workstations, maybe in some enterprise settings. And there were also some stuff related to 3D with 3D displays. These have never ever really been a thing, so them not being supported is also no big loss, I think. So, solid roadmap. Hopefully they can accomplish this. The multiplexing thing is the most important, in my opinion. It will solve a bunch of problems with hybrid laptops. So hopefully they get on that and Wayland compositors start implementing a way to support this properly as well. Now, a Linux kernel developer is taking issue with the way Tuxedo is handling their open source drivers. Tuxedo, if you don't know, and you probably do know them by now because I talk about them all the time, they are a regular sponsor of the channel, they are a PC reseller. They take popular models from manufacturers like Tongfang and Clevo. They test them extensively under Linux. They pick the hardware that works best, and the parts that don't work as well as they'd like to or not at all, they develop drivers for, and they ship that as GPL V3 open source drivers that anyone can use and package. And obviously, they then sell these computers to people with the drivers pre-installed in a version of a distro that they ship, whether it be Ubuntu. I think they also have OpenSUSE or Kubuntu, and their own version, which is Tuxedo OS. Their drivers are open source. They're licensed under the GPL V3. But the issue here is that the Linux kernel itself is GPL V2, and you cannot mix GPL V2 and V3 code together all that well, because the GPL V3 adds more restriction on what you can do with the code, and those restrictions would also apply to the GPL V2 code around it, except the GPL V2 code is not supposed to have more restrictions than what the GPL V2 authorizes. So basically, it's a mess. Those licenses were kind of dumb and don't really work together, and so you can't really mix both unless you go through a bunch of weird hoops in rewriting certain things. A kernel developer doesn't think that's right, and they're creating a set of patches to prevent Tuxedo drivers from accessing the debugging symbols from the Linux kernel. He basically says that these drivers are kind of proprietary because they can't be included as is, which means that basically they're not as open source as Tuxedo wants to say. This is a technique that they implemented a while back with NVIDIA drivers as well to make sure that the drivers could not interact with GPL V2 code. The issue that the kernel developer raises here specifically is that the Tuxedo drivers rely on a module to include their GPL license compatibility information. That module states broad GPL compatibility. A patch was offered to fix that, to state that they are just compatible with GPL V3, but not with older versions. That patch was accepted, but was then reverted, because apparently you cannot just change this information without the consent of all of the authors of all the code in the drivers, and Tuxedo just cannot get that in a timely fashion, because they are not the only ones who wrote all of the code for their drivers. Tuxedo then answered the problem, at least one of their developers did. It's Werner, it's someone I interviewed a while back in a special episode of my weekly news audio podcast. He said that unfortunately this issue cannot be solved overnight. He says that it's an honest mistake. They never really wanted to state that they're compatible with a version of the GPL that they're not compatible with, and they're working on solving the issue. They're basically rewriting their entire driver repo to upstream all the drivers under the GPL V2. This work is also in a public GitHub repo. He says it's an honest mistake. They started working on the drivers. They didn't check on that module compatibility thing. Some people contributed some code under the GPL V3 and under that module, and they basically cannot relicense everything as is. There are some legal things to solve first. They're also saying that the code itself right now would just not be accepted as is in the Linux kernel, because their goal when they wrote those drivers was to provide a working driver that is stable and just supports the hardware, lets the devices work properly. But the style of the code or its architecture isn't necessarily up to the kernel standards, which are very high. They also specified that it doesn't mean that their drivers are bad quality, but they're just not written in a way that kernel developers would agree to. In the end, it is an annoying situation, for sure. You just picked a license that doesn't really work with the kernel license. It's kind of dumb and it's annoying, and it would be better if anyone could grab those drivers, propose them for inclusion in the kernel. Tuxedo would probably do it themselves and there would be no problem. I also think that the Linux kernel developer reaction here is a bit exaggerated, calling these drivers proprietary when anyone can grab them, compile them as a module and ship them in an external repo. That's a bit much. Like Fedora, there is a copper repo that has the drivers. They're probably also in the AUR, and I'm pretty sure I saw an OpenSUSE repo that includes them as well. So they can be used and they're actually being used. They're open source. I don't quite see this as a big problem. It is annoying. It needs to be fixed. This code should be usable by anyone who wants to redistribute them inside of a patched Linux kernel. This should be doable. Currently, it's not. So I hope they fix this. They're saying they're fixing it. They have the repo and the code to prove that they are starting to do it. I don't think assuming malicious intent here is right, and I don't think you should waste valuable developer time on the kernel to actually prevent these drivers from interfacing with the kernel. But then again, you will tell me what you think about this issue if you're more extremist about how licenses should be used and how they are compatible. You might not agree with me here. Now, Ubuntu provided a roadmap for their next version, 25.04. Of course, it's planned for April next year because that's how Ubuntu releases work. And among the usual changes, like moving to the next GNOME version, GNOME 48 in this case, and the latest Linux kernel version, not necessarily the stable one, but the latest available version, even if it's not fully finalized, they will also refine their installer, notably to make creating a dual boot easier. They basically want to be clearer about the other installed operating systems when you try to install Ubuntu, and they want to refine how you can free up some space and how you can replace an existing Ubuntu install. They also want to improve how they handle BitLocker encrypted Windows installs, because right now they will just ask you to boot into Windows, to turn BitLocker off, and then to reinstall Ubuntu or to try to reinstall Ubuntu because they cannot just support decrypting this stuff. Apparently, they will try and fix that. Their full disk encryption solution using the TPM chip of your computer is also moving forward nicely. They hope they'll be able to make the NVIDIA drivers support this feature as well. Their security center will also gain the ability to handle the encryption password and PIN. Accessibility will be a focus as well. They have ordered a third-party audit on their desktop experience. They identified areas that need to improve, like keyboard navigation, the screen reader, and high contrast mode. And they want to solve these things in this development cycle and collaborate with upstream communities. But they only cited Yaru and Flutter, so I'm thinking they want to fix things in their own apps, and they're going to let GNOME developers fix their own accessibility stuff, which, fortunately, that's what they're doing in the GNOME 48 cycle with the Sovereign Tech Foundation projects. Hopefully, these improvements to the screen reader and to GNOME accessibility also land in GNOME 48. Ubuntu Core Desktop will also be moving along, this being their immutable distro based on snaps, and they're basically separating layers a bit more. They plan to have a snap for the kernel, a snap for the windowing server, a snap for certain drivers, a snap for the desktop environment, and snaps for each app. But they're also now separating some core services like Pipewire into their own snaps as well, so the install can be more modular. Other changes in Ubuntu 25.04 will include replacing the old Evince PDF reader by Papers. It's a new GNOME app that has the same feature set, but they are pretty much better implemented and better integrated with current Advaita guidelines. They will also improve the Firefox snap and add some fixes around Wayland and NVIDIA. All in all, it is a solid list of features for this new version, and it's the version where they can take risks because it's not an LTS. They have a few versions to implement things, test things out. And it will only be interesting to you if you like the current Ubuntu ecosystem and their snaps and their own apps. I'm not the biggest fan of all of this, but I can at least appreciate how far this ecosystem has come. Ubuntu now offers a pretty good experience around all the snaps, the permissions you can have, and their own apps. I still prefer Flatpaks to snaps, but I can appreciate how solid it now is. Now, the hits keep coming to debunk most marketing claims made by AI companies. A recent study showed that large language models simply do not currently have any coherent understanding of the world or its rules, and thus fail at tasks that they succeeded at previously. For example, a recent AI model was able to provide turn-by-turn directions in New York City without ever having access to a full map of the city. It's only building its own map based on what other drivers have done. Once researchers started closing down some roads, though, to mimic, for example, some heavy work being done in the streets, then the model completely crumbled, because what the researchers found is that the model had generated non-existent streets that connected various parts of the city, and it just decided that it would use these streets instead of the real ones that actually exist. Researchers said that this capacity to form a coherent view of what is real and what can be generated and what should only be based on real-world physical stuff, This ability is crucial to apply these models in important science-related scenarios, and currently they do not have this ability to discern what is expected of them, generating a traffic guide, but not generating streets in this case. Using other metrics, they discovered that basically AI performs really well, but it never understands the rules of what you're asking it to do. The models will just try every combination possible and keep repeating the ones that yield the best results and are the most satisfactory for the user of the AI model or the parameters of its training. This doesn't mean that the AI understands the limits that they shouldn't cross or that are illegal, as in they could not be done in real life. In the example of the turn-by-turn direction model of New York City, once researchers closed just 1% of available streets, the model's accuracy plummeted to 67% from basically 99%, meaning it was instantly unsuitable for purpose because navigation only works if it offers real streets to navigate. Anything that is too far from 100% accuracy is unacceptable in this context. So what they're saying is the AI simply does not understand the real rules. It arrives at a positive result with the wrong methods. It just tries every combination until it lands in something that works and that no one says, hey, you shouldn't do that. But it has no capacity for understanding what it can do and what it cannot do in the physical world unless this capacity has been manually programmed into the model, which instantly makes most of these models completely unsuitable for a lot of real-world tasks. It's not important when you're asking an AI to summarize some text. It just arrives at a legible text that seems coherent because it tried again and again and again when training itself to write text that is judged acceptable, and so it can do it. But it has no real understanding of grammar, of words, of punctuation, or anything. It just mimics stuff that you find acceptable. When you use that in more critical contexts, though, like science or turn-by-turn navigation or medical stuff, then automatically this makes it unsuitable for purpose because it just doesn't understand and it will offer solutions that cannot be implemented at all or take wrong deductions because the result feels like it could be right. Now, this week we saw a big update to DXVK version 2.5. If you don't know yet, this library is used to translate DirectX 8, 9, 10, and 11 games into Vulkan games. All the instructions that these games rely upon are translated into Vulkan instructions that Linux can understand. The new version of DXVK brings a completely rewritten way of handling memory, which seems to result in a lot more VRAM being made available to games. Basically, what it does is it defragments how the VRAM is used. It defragments the VRAM, which frequently returns VRAM that was previously unusable to the game that you're playing. If you are familiar with old Windows file systems that needed to be defragmented, that's the same thing. Basically, as you write stuff and remove stuff from the disk or from the RAM, you leave really small spaces that can be used to write fragments of the information you want, but then retrieving these fragments gets increasingly harder and harder because you have to remember where all of these fragments are, where they're located, and go fetch each of them one by one, which can have worse performance than just writing all of this information next to each other. So you have to defragment to put all of these little fragments next together. This feature will work better if your GPU drivers are relatively recent, so you need the Mesa 24 drivers or the NVIDIA drivers 560. Almost any distro that you would want to use for gaming should have access to that. This should result in less lockups in game and a bit better performance. There's also new stuff added, like support for emulated cursors, so games can set an image as the mouse cursor properly. There's Unreal Engine 3 games that should have been improved and work better, some specific fixes for Command & Conquer Generals, for Tomb Raider Legends, or Rayman 3. And there should also be improvements for CPU-bound games that should gain more stability and more performance, especially in 32-bit games like Total War Rome 2 or Total War Warhammer 3. All in all, it is a big update to DXVK that should improve performance and stability for a lot of older titles, and Not necessarily older titles, because even recent games generally offer a DirectX 11 backend, because a lot of computers still cannot run DirectX 12 well. So DirectX 11 is still used in a lot of recent games. So having these features is nice for everyone. Now, Fedora shared some details about their new Anaconda installer redesign this week. First, they outlined why they needed a new installer, notably why they needed a new interface for the installer. And the reason is simply to guide people in a more step-by-step manner, something that people are familiar with, which the current Anaconda installer isn't really. It's just designed in a weird hub way that doesn't feel familiar. They say most installs should not require more than clicking next a few times, and I totally agree with the sentiment. What they ended up going with is a task-oriented design. They identified the various use cases that people had when installing Fedora. First, using the whole disk, or trying to do a dual boot, or reinstalling Fedora, or setting a custom install with a custom partition layout. That's how they decided to organize the installer with these four use cases. As per using a web-based toolkit instead of GTK, they say it's because the old installer was reliant on GTK 3, which is now old, it's still maintained, but they would still have to rewrite everything to GTK 4 if they wanted to change the interface. So if they're gonna rewrite, they decided to use a web-based interface instead, and they render that UI with Firefox, so they're not using Chromium or Electron here. Now, the benefits of that web-based UI is that it's easier to update and maintain for them, and presumably they're gonna get more contributions because more people are familiar with web technologies than people are familiar with GTK. All in all, this installer looks fine. Visually, it's pretty drab. It looks like Windows 8 style applications, not like a mix of old Windows controls and big blue buttons. Not a big fan of the visual style, but the step-by-step process will probably be much better than the current Anaconda installer. I don't think we need that many installers, honestly. I like the diversity in Linux. I like having choices for my applications. I like having choices for my distros, for the various subsystems. But for the installer, does it really bring a lot of value? You already have Calamares, the old and the new Ubuntu installers. You also have the OpenSUSE installer, which they're also rewriting. Everyone seems to be writing their own stuff, and I don't think we need that many because in the end, all they're doing is placing files on a disk. You shouldn't need 20,000 ways of doing that, and I think it's kind of wasted work in this specific context, but at least Fedora users will get something that feels better than the current version of the installer that they use, which is a total UI nightmare. Now this week, we also got some details from Valve on their recent work to fix annoying bugs and issues on the Steam client on Linux. They have a semi-technical blog post in which they say that the Linux APIs that they had to work with, specifically getenv and setenv, are some of the worst Linux APIs that exist. These are used to get the values of environment variables and to set environment variables as well, and apparently these are just not safe to use in multi-threaded environments. And so Valve wanted to minimize how much they relied on these things. Apparently, using setenv can crash a program outright, or at least crash an entire thread. And so by removing most calls to these APIs, they've made the Steam client much more stable and reliable. These issues with those two APIs are being addressed in glibc, the basis for most C implementations on Linux, but for now, Valve wants to move around these APIs as much as they can because they're just not reliable for what they need to do. Valve also said that developing on Linux isn't the easiest thing because, for example, getting crash reports is not great. There is so much variance between distros, driver versions, window managers, subsystems, user customization, and other things that the reports simply cannot be exploited and grouped automatically as they could be on Windows, for example. You could get two bug reports for the same issue, but you wouldn't be able to collect them in the same place because the way of writing the bug report and the various subsystem versions are so different that you wouldn't be able to identify that this concerns the same problem. Now, this is one of the big advantages of containerized application formats. Yes, I'm going to be the Flatpak shill here again, but this format solves these problems. If you use the Flatpak version of an application, you have one unified environment in which you run this thing, and so all your bug reports will be the exact same and the same format and have the same kind of library information at the very least. It doesn't solve bad APIs or bad system calls, but at least for the bug report things, it's solved. So Valve, enforce the Flatpak. It's a good format to use. Now we have some interesting news on the search engines front. Ecosia partnered up with Quant to build a common index that doesn't rely on big search engines like Google or Bing. Quant is a French-based search engine that as a search tool isn't bad as a company. They seem to have a few skeletons in their closet, notably in terms of doing the usual startup thing of focusing on 30 different projects, not giving the time for the staff to do them properly, and make all that work meaningless by shifting priorities all the time. Not great, but as a search engine, it seems to be pretty usable. Ecosia is a German engine that uses Bing and plants trees in exchange for ads being displayed in the searches. It's all privacy preserving, and it seems to be actual good tree planting compared to just planting the same species 20 million times in the exact same place, which generally yields negative results. So they're apparently relying on a foundation that does that properly. Now, the two engines are entering a partnership to build their own index. Both engines currently rely on Bing. Bing's API costs have been rising a lot, and they want their independence. Now, the not-so-good part is that they will also use that work to fuel generative AI development to make search engines that combine regular search and AI, much like what every other search engine is doing, with generated snippets that give you one answer above all search results, if you trust that answer, which you absolutely shouldn't. They're expecting that index to be usable early next year, first in France and then in Germany by the end of 2025, presumably the rest of the world after that. Other independent indexes include Brave Search, but Quant and Ecosia say that they're taking a different approach. Brave apparently emulated the structure of what Google and Microsoft are doing. Quant and Ecosia want to make something different by indexing all of the available pages, not just big category headers, and also trying to really understand what each page talks about, not just relying on some basic word matching. I'm not sure what the result of this will be, if it's going to be a usable search engine or if it's not going to make a difference. It's probably never going to make a dent in Google's market share. That's 100% certain. And the fact that they want to tack on some AI-related features on top of this makes me kind of not sure because, well, AI is a different thing than search. You shouldn't mix the two. In one case, I want a summary of something. In another case, I want some actual results that I can sift through. I don't want a summary of all the results because that's just one viewpoint and it's never the right way of approaching any topic. Even with these news, don't just listen to my interpretation of them. Go see other Linux creators that talk about these things and have different opinions. Now we have some interesting stuff coming to Proton Experimental this week, most notably support for NVIDIA Optical Flow and DLSS3. The first one is an API that is used to do object tracking, and it's used in conjunction with DLSS3, which is a frame generation technology. So DLSS3 can basically create frames to simulate smoother gameplay on lower-end computers. For example, your computer might only render the game at 45 FPS, but it's going to be displayed at 60 because one frame every three frames is going to be added on top and created by DLSS3. And these frames are created properly thanks to the Optical Flow API that does object tracking and makes sure that what is displayed in these frames is accurate. This does add a bit of latency for games, of course, but in a lot of games, you just wouldn't really care because you don't need split-second reflexes in every type of game that you play. All in all, what it means is that games that offer the option for DLSS3 should play nice on Linux, which is good. Proton also fixed a lot of stuff for specific games like Star Wars Jedi Knight 2, Dragon Age The Veilguard, Skull and Bones, or Rivals of Aether 2. Now that is pretty cool stuff and pretty encouraging too. If our platform can keep up with all of that work and all of these technologies in a reasonable manner, in a reasonable time frame, then I think we're gonna keep being a suitable gaming platform. And honestly, not many people are ever going to own a GPU capable of doing 4K ultra settings at 120 FPS, but you might be able to almost have that same experience by using a way cheaper GPU and using upscaling tech and frame generation tech to feel like it's 4K 60 or 4K 120 when it's actually not that. And to conclude this episode, we now have RISC-V boards for the Framework laptop. I talked about it a while ago. Framework had a partnership with Deep Computing. That's a company building RISC-V computers. And the results of that partnership are now available, but only for enterprise and business consumers. It's a pretty underpowered board. It's nothing comparable to what you could get usually in a Framework laptop. It's a Star 5 JH7110. It's a quad-core chip that can go up to 1.5 GHz. It's 8 gigs of RAM. It's nothing to be super excited about. Since it's so far from what Framework consumers usually get, it is only marketed as an early access program for enterprise and business. It's not even targeted at potential Linux developers that would want to do RISC-V dev. The board apparently supports Ubuntu 24.04 and Fedora 41, but all distros that have kind of the same level of internals should work fine as well. And the board is $199 at its cheapest. Obviously, it's like half the price of the cheapest 11th gen Intel i7 board from Framework. It's $400 for that. It's the cheapest they offer currently. But obviously, the Star 5 board will deliver probably less than a quarter of the performance of that i7. So it really is just for ultra enthusiasts or for very specific use cases. If you want the whole Framework laptop around that RISC-V board as well, it will cost you $800. It's not that bad for a full laptop that you could just decide to upgrade later by buying a more powerful x86 board. Now, I know some people think that RISC-V is going nowhere because currently all we're seeing is pretty underpowered dual-core or quad-core CPUs. But let's remember that ARM was the exact same thing 8 to 10 years ago. It just was not suitable to be placed inside of day-to-day laptops or desktops. And look where it is now. It even outclasses x86 in performance per watt, and it can definitely rival Core i9s and Core i7s in certain instances. There's no reason to think that RISC-V could never catch up to that same level of performance, but since it is an open architecture, it's probably not a bad thing if RISC-V progresses fast. So this board, I have zero interest in. It's a downgrade in every regard and it would never fit my use cases, but it's good to see that it's coming. Anyway, this will conclude today's episode. I hope you enjoyed listening to it. As always, if you want to learn more about any of these topics, all the links that I used to create this show are in the show notes. And as always, if you want to support this show, you have plenty of links in the show notes as well. In the meantime, thank you all for listening, and I guess you'll hear me in the next one next week. Bye!